Well, thank you everyone for joining. This talk today is different from the first in a number of respects. Number one, the content is clearly a little different. Number two, it is much more lo-fi. There's no PowerPoint. It is not a formal talk. I don't have a paper that I'm reading. This is exploratory material. It's material that I when Lucien asked me to send in some abstracts for talks, I figured this would be a good push for me to get my thoughts together on a new chapter that I wanted to add into my book that has not been in my dissertation. And so it was a little ambitious, and I have not yet made my way through all of the research and the reading that I wanted to do for this chapter. So it's very much a work in progress, very informal. Probably won't go, I won't speak for very long, but I would love to hear all of your thoughts, and to just hear what you find interesting from this material that I have developed and any other avenues or directions that you can see me taking this. So I appreciate all of your comments and all of your questions and directions in that regard. So Sanskrit knowledge production in the Swaminarayan tradition. For those of you who were present yesterday, we had a visitor, Sadhu Bhadresh Das, who has a litany of titles. He is a PhD, DLit, a Mahamahopadhyay, and then also a string of other titles conferred upon him by various associational bodies. And he came and he shared a little bit about the work that he is doing. One of the things that he mentioned while he was here was that he had recently traveled to Jagannath Puri and to Tirupati, where he engaged in Shastartha disputation with a series of pundits, all in Sanskrit, lasting several days. So that is kind of an interesting mirror to the conversation that we had about Shastarthas and debates in my first talk. This talk, in a way, is trying to think through how did Bhadresh Swami happen, right? Where does his work and his motivation, his inspiration, his role within the Swaminarayan community, where does that come from? How do we understand that? And how does that help us understand Sanskrit knowledge production, not just in the Swaminarayan tradition, but in contemporary, well, in colonial and then also post-colonial contemporary India, right? So kind of thinking through that. So the first thing I'd like to do is to step back to the time of Swaminarayan, the turn of the 19th century. And I want to read to you some sort of selections from literature, the early literature of the tradition. The first is from a Gujarati text called the Sriharilamrit, right? So the nectar of the play of Srihari. I'll just read part of it in Gujarati and then the translation. Shriji Swami kahe susant amne vidya bhane te game mate sne samet nitya bhanjo vidya visheshe tame pushti santata sampraday tani to vidvan thi thai che jo vidvan na hoy sadhu jan to te panth nindai che. Shriji Swami says, O virtuous sant, I like when someone studies the higher knowledge. Therefore, especially study this knowledge daily and with love. A sampraday is continuously nourished by its scholars. A group, a panth, where sadhus are not learned becomes reproachable. So here, the depiction is that Sajjanand Swami is not only exhorting all of his sadhus to become learned, to become educated, but also mapping his vision of what his community should be. He's demarcating between a panth, a path, a group, a small group, which is one in which sadhus are not learned, and so it is reproachable, and a sampradaya, one that continues, one that is nourished by its scholars. In an 1824 sermon given in the town of Garuda in 1824, which is collected in the series of sermons called the Vachanamrita, this is it sort of collated between 1819 and 1829, and it represents a bunch of teachings of Sajanand Swami, Swami Narayan. Very interestingly, there is an indication of where they are, what time of day it is, who is present, down to what Sajanand Swami is wearing, and then sort of a transcript of sorts of what took place. So this particular Vachanamrita, Garuda section 2, number 58, is titled, each Vachanamrita has its own title. So this one is called The Flourishing of a Sampradaya. And I'll read from that at length. Shriji Maharaj asked, how do the sampradayas of the great acharyas flourish for a long period of time? Muktanand Swami answered, so this is one of his disciples. A lot of these are sort of question-answer type conversations. So Muktanand Swami answered, firstly, by the scriptures of the sampradaya. Secondly, by the observance of the dharma of one's caste and ashram as prescribed in the scriptures. And thirdly, by total conviction in one's ishtadev. One sampradaya flourishes by these three factors. Shriji Maharaj is not quite convinced yet, so he then asked the same question to Brahmanand Swami and Nityanand Swami. They also gave the same reply. Thereafter, Shriji Maharaj said, here, allow me to answer the question. A sampradaya flourishes by knowing the following. The purpose for which the Ishtadev of the Sampradaya manifested on earth, and after manifesting, the various divine actions he performed, as well as the ways in which he behaved. Through his behavior, Dharma, as well as the greatness of that Ishtadev, is naturally revealed. In this manner, then, a Sampradaya is fostered by the scriptures which narrate its Ishtadev's divine incidents from his birth up until his passing away. Regardless of whether those scriptures are in Sanskrit or in the vernacular, only those scriptures will foster the Sampradaya, not others. For example, those who worship Ramchandra Bhagwan will be inspired only by the Valmiki Ramayana. And those who worship Sri Krishna Bhagwan will be inspired only by the 10th and 11th cantos of the Srimad Bhagavat. The Vedas will not inspire those who worship Ramchandraji Bhagwan or Sri Krishna Bhagwan. Ultimately, then, only the scriptures of one's own sampradaya will foster the sampradaya. Having said this, Sriji Maharaj then commanded Muktanand Swami, you too should continuously preach and write scriptures related to your sampradaya and your Ishtadev for the rest of your life. This is my only command to you for as long as you live. And every indication suggests that this is what Muktanand Swami did. One more little quotation. This is from the Shikshapatri, which is a Sanskrit text which represents 212 shlokas that are the kind of, sometimes have been referred to as the Dharma Shastra of the Swaminarayan Sampradaya. A copy of which, sort of a manuscript of which is extant in the Bodleian Library. As I mentioned last time, Avni Chug has done some very pathbreaking work comparing all sorts of manuscripts and recensions on this that has the potential to shift the way that we think about the Shikshapatri. But for now, we'll go with the received understanding that this is Swaminarayan's own creation. So verse 132 of the Shikshapatri says, Samstapya vipram vidvamsam patashalam vidapya cha pravartaniya sadvidya bhuvi yat sukritum mahat. This is found in a section in which the duties of the acharya, which for the early Swaminarayan community, the acharya referred to the administrative heads of the two sort of dioceses, sometimes referred to. Basically, a line was drawn between Dwarka and Kashi. Everything north was supposed to be administered by the Gadi, the seat based in Ahmedabad. Everything south of it, the Gadi based in Vartal. And Sajanan Swami adopted the children of his two brothers and established one in each, and their offspring were meant to lead those. So this was an exhortation to what those acharyas should do, right? They should establish a pathshala and employ a learned Brahmin or scholar. Sadvidya should be spread in the world. It is a great undertaking, right? So here we have three different sort of indications about text and about sampradaya and all of that filtered through education and writing. So this I sort of wanted to use to frame how we can think through what's going on in the Swaminarayan tradition. But now let's take a step back even more. And let's think about the way that Sanskrit has been talked about in this time period, right? Of course, this is a topic of quite a sort of a healthy body of scholarship. For example, the life and death of Sanskrit has been much debated. Even before, well, let's start with in 1883, as part of Max Müller's Cambridge lecture series, What Can India Teach Us? His third lecture was called Human Interest of Sanskrit Literature. And I'll quote from parts of that here. He says, and this is sort of based on his understanding of Buddhist texts and et cetera. He says, Sanskrit, therefore, as a language spoken by the people at large, had ceased to exist in the 3rd century BC. Yet, such is the marvelous continuity between the past and the present in India that, in spite of repeated social convulsions, religious reforms, and foreign invasions, Sanskrit may be said to be still the only language that is spoken over the whole extent of that vast country. Even at the present moment, after a century of English rule and English teaching, I believe that Sanskrit is more widely understood in India than Latin was in Europe at the time of Dante. Whenever I receive a letter from a learned man in India, it is written in Sanskrit. Whenever there is a controversy on questions of law and religion, the pamphlets published in India are written in Sanskrit. There are journals written in Sanskrit, which must entirely depend for their support on readers who prefer that classical language to the vulgar dialects. He then goes on to list a bunch of these publications, these journals, and a whole bunch of texts, et cetera, et cetera. This is in 1883. Now, of course, in the sort of the Western Academy, these conversations look a little bit different. In 2001, Sheldon Pollack published an article called The Death of Sanskrit, in which he pointed to various moments in the second millennium, four particularly, where Sanskrit seems to curiously have disappeared. And his sort of pronouncement is that by 1800, Sanskrit ceases to function as a language of creativity, vitality. I forget the exact words, but that's his sort of general thesis. Now, of course, there was sort of, I remember there was a big symposium for the Language of the Gods and the Worlds of Men, led by his doctoral students who had all become professors, including my supervisor, Ajay Rao. And in that sort of symposium, all of his students took him to task and really kind of ripped into large parts of his argument. And his response to all of this was that he was really happy with this and that he propose an argument that lots of people engaged with and sort of broke down rather than a weak argument that nobody touched at all. And certainly, this death of Sanskrit is a provocative thesis that many people have engaged with. There have been careful rejoinders by Jürgen Hanader, by Brian Hatcher. There have been polemical rejoinders by people like Rajiv Malhotra. So lots there that kind of question the extent to which Sanskrit is sort of alive or dead. Certainly, just empirically speaking, it is not dead. But what are the transformations? What are the changes that we can chart? That sort of becomes the more salient question than whether it is alive or dead. Now, in thinking about Sanskrit and language choice, a lot of the scholarship places its emphasis on ideology, sort of the concept of ideology, specifically the connection between power and legitimation. Some of these draw on the work of Pierre Bourdieu, who sort of thinks of action as an interplay between habitus, which is a set of dispositions, which sort of are inculcated, structured, durable. This is kind of the standard adjectives. So those dispositions sort of give you a range of responses, and then also a particular social field or a social market in which Bourdieu is very interested in how the role of capital plays. Not just economic capital, he's more interested in cultural or symbolic capital. So a lot of these ideas about Sanskrit and language use think about how Sanskrit sort of is a language that sort of has considerable cultural and symbolic capital, and how this language, and sort of not just Bourdieu, of course, lots of other people, how then Sanskrit is a language that is used for legitimation, to sort of shore up power, et cetera, et cetera, right? Now, these ideas have been very generative to think through in terms of Sanskrit and education in the colonial and post-colonial period. I'm thinking about works by Brian Hatcher, Michael Dodson, Simona Sani, Sumathi Ramaswamy. I'll sort of get to some of these sort of momentarily. But in particular, where I sort of want to start to think through all of this sort of body of literature is something that Brian Hatcher says in his most recent book, Hinduism Before Reform. In this book, he is comparing the work of Sajjanan Swami and Ram Mohan Roy, these two people who are contemporaries and who are sort of connected to this idea of reform, but often not thought of together. And so his book is trying to think about how we can understand what is going on with these two figures and the disparate legacies of the communities that they set up. Now, what he calls for is for us to decouple from the teleologies of reform, empire, and the nation. And I think this is a very important sort of call. He's, of course, most interested in the idea of reform. But in his mind, the kind of periodization that people always sort of deal with is between the pre-modern and the modern. And for him, this isn't necessarily very productive, especially for the time period that he's interested in. And he thinks it's more productive to think about the early colonial versus the late colonial, and how there is a particular logic of empire, nation, and reform that comes through in the late colonial period that doesn't really exist in the early colonial period. And for him, this sort of opens up a brand new avenue to think and to sort of reassess the work of Sajjanan Swami and Ram Mohan Roy. Now, Michael Dodson writing before him, of course, he has sort of pushed back against such neat periodizations, and particularly in terms of the Orientalist Anglicist controversy, which I'll get to in just a moment. But his sort of point is that even saying that there is an early colonial and late colonial sort of moment, and that is the moment, is a bit of a false binary. And any sort of aspect of periodization is sort of going to distort the picture for us a little bit. But still, let's think about, I want to sort of keep in the back of our heads, or back of my head, my mind, this decoupling from the teleology of empire and the nation, right? Because what I find is that current studies of Sanskrit are still rooted in these ideas of legitimation and of cultural and symbolic capital, particularly read through the teleologies of either the empire or the nation. For example, thinking about British education and the sort of the what their aims were in setting up things like the Benares Sanskrit College, right? And then also in the post-colonial scenario, nationalist policies, right? So there is the 1957 Sanskrit Commission, which sort of does its own study of Sanskrit in the sort of post-independence moment and comes up with a series of recommendations on how to continue with Sanskrit education. And of course, this continues all through various governments and their initiatives in terms of promoting the education of Sanskrit. Again, what I find is that people are focused on either this idea of the logic of empire or the logic of the nation. These are, again, hugely important in thinking through historical transformations. But even Pollock in Language of the Gods, which many people have sort of pushed back against, he offers a very thorough criticism of the lens of legitimation. In his analysis of the sort of the biography of Sanskrit and then the vernacular languages, which he reads through the terms of literalization and literarization, and thinking about aesthetics and power, for him, legitimation is not enough. And it's a very complex sort of theoretical discussion that he has there in thinking about the way that agency factors, etc. But ultimately, he comes to the point that sometimes there's something about these languages themselves that it's not just about legitimation, but it is about something to do with those languages that, for a number of reasons, the people using them see that language to be particularly useful. And not just useful in a strategic way, but in an aesthetic sense or any number of ways, right? So, following that, I sort of want to think through what are other registers? What are other ways that we can think about how Sanskrit operates beyond just legitimation, authorization, empire, and the modern nation state, right? Now, of course, thinking about nation and thinking about empire is useful to a certain extent, and it does sort of give us a lot of data to sort of sort through, right? The British, as we know, they were they instituted a document raj, in the words of Bhavani Raman. And they did all sorts of studies. So in 1813, the Charter Act of 1813, it set up 100,000 rupees that were supposed to be earmarked for education and the sort of the encouragement of native literatures. Now, how was that going to be spent? How should that be spent? So many British officials thought, let's get a lay of the land. And they engaged in a bunch of surveys of the status of native education in various provinces. This resulted in William Adams' report of Bengal and Bihar, Munro's report on Pondicherry and Madras, various reports to the Bombay government. And what these show, I'm sort of still working my way through these reports. There's a lot of data there. What these show us is that there are two separate sort of tiers of education. One is what we would consider regular schools, and which all these colonial officials describe as teaching the three R's: reading, writing, and arithmetic. And those, you know, people would study for at these places for anywhere from 2 to 5 years, and a number of from a number of backgrounds, some Brahmins, a lot of Vaishyas, Kshatriyas, some Shudras. So there's this model of education, and there are thousands and thousands of these very small schools. And then there are fewer pathshalas or madrasas, right? And this is where these were sort of more rigorous, and they were primarily geared towards Brahmins, right? So we get sort of a picture that in the early 19th century, we do have these two systems of education. And sort of, we also have, of course, a pre-colonial record of some of these and various sort of centers of learning that exist in Benares, in Pune. There's sort of all these records about how the Peshwas gave thousands and thousands of rupees as dakshina to various Brahmins in Pune, and people would come from all over India to get these. And there were sort of two different types. You could either sort of take a little exam where somebody would sort of test you on your learning, and then you'd get a certain amount, or you could sort of go to the other section and just by virtue of being there, you would get something, right? And people would come from Karnataka, from Gujarat, but also there are records of people coming from all over the place. Centers of learning in Nadia, Navadvipa. So we have sort of these accounts of traditional systems of education. Then, of course, we have British institutions that are set up. So Sanskrit colleges in Benares, the Benares Sanskrit College was set up in 1781, and Michael Dodson has done a very sort of thorough study of the Benares College. 1825, a college at Calcutta. In 1829, a college in Pune is set up. And this one is sort of interesting because once the British take over from the Marathas, they decide to continue this Dakshina system. But at a certain point, there is a little bit of a debate over how much money to give, who to give, and they decide to earmark some of those funds instead for the establishment of this Sanskrit college in Pune. Oriental colleges are subsequently set up in Delhi and Agra. And then, of course, in the 1830s, we have what is known as the Orientalist and the Anglicist debate, where Orientalists are arguing for the continuance of education along traditional lines, and Anglicists are saying, no, let's teach through English, let's teach Western ideas, and this culminates in the infamous Minute on Indian Education by Macaulay, which sort of is seen as and the sort of the approval of that minute is seen as kind of the end of the debate. But what a lot of scholars have shown is that, in fact, this generated quite a bit of backlash, both from Indians, but also from Orientalists. And this resulted in not as sort of, it's not quite as clear cut as, well, there was Orientalist education to a certain point and then Anglicists. And there are certain compromises that were set up. For example, while missionaries sort of were allowed to establish more systems of education, there was still a some governmental emphasis on native education as well. Now, let me sort of speed through this a little bit. There are all sorts of education commissions set up throughout the rest of colonial rule. In 1904, there is the Indian Universities Act, in which a whole, there's a wide number of universities that are set up based on the model of the Western university. And then in 1921, education and health are both made provincial matters as opposed to sort of empire matters. And then independence, 1947, the Sanskrit Commission of 1957. All of these, what they show is that what this results in is another set of parallel tracks of higher education, in which there is the Pathshala system, but also the system of Sanskrit being taught in universities. And Michael Dodson, Axel Michaels, Madhav Deshpande have all sort of focused on this in various ways. And their sort of conclusion is that this sort of shift to the university system does sort of diminish the capacity of the Pathshalas, that there's significantly more resources that are invested in this university model as opposed to Pathshalas, right? But again, this is still focusing in on empire, focusing in on nation. So let's now go back very quickly, so we have time to talk, about the Swaminarayan tradition, right? In the early 19th century, Sajanand Swami, some of his sadhus came in with significant Sanskrit education, and others, there are indications that there are sort of references of him sending some of his sadhus off to study, including Muktanand Swami. So at the age of, he was in his 50s, and Sajanand Swami told him, go learn Sanskrit so that you can write texts. There is a sort of, in between the 1820s and 1850s, there is kind of an explosion of Sanskrit textual output. One such text is the Satsangi Jivan. In 1829, this text is written, almost 20,000 verses. Peter Schreiner, his analysis of it shows that it is modeled very largely after the Bhagavata Purana, but it is a sacred biography in Sanskrit that sort of traces the entire life of Swaminarayan. In 1830, or as some of my manuscript work has shown, perhaps not until 1850, there's another text in Sanskrit, another sacred biographical text called the Srihari Digvijaya, which is one that I brought up in our talk last time, which the story is that Sajanand Swami really liked the Satsangi Jivan, and then he turned to an even more educated, more erudite sadhu, Nityanand Swami, and said, I want you to write a text that is all about the debates that I have had, and that the debates that have been had in this community. So kind of in some ways very similar to Digvijaya texts that we see in other sampradayas. Then there is the Harivakya Sudha Sindhu, which is a translation of the Vachnamrita, which I talked about earlier today, into Sanskrit. There are a series of commentarial texts. The Shikshapatri, which was that 212 verse text that Sajjanand Swami is said to have written. There is a commentary that is composed on that. There are all sorts of Vedantic commentarial texts that are written. And this story is extremely, extremely complicated and one that I deal with in other parts of my work. So if we want to talk about that, we can talk about that later. There are all sorts of stotra texts that are composed, right? So a real proliferation of these texts in this early period. There are also pachshalas that are established. So in Ahmedabad, the first acharya, he takes that exhortation that Sajjanand Swami said, you know, acharya should set this up. He establishes a pachshala in Galupur, and it's said to have been active for the entire time. In recent years, the acharya moved it from the temple to one location and then another location about 20 miles outside of Ahmedabad. Vartal, there were various attempts to establish a pachshala and then sort of sometimes it fell into disarray. We have evidence that in 1909, there was a new pachshala that was set up. And for roughly the first 30 years of its existence, the office of Pradhana Pandita was held by a figure named Embar Krishnamacharya, who was notably a Sri Vaishnava figure from Srirangam. Some sources indicate that he's said to have undertaken many activities in the Sampradaya to propagate Vedanta in both Sanskrit and vernacular languages. He edited a host of Swaminarayan texts published through the Vartal Sampradaya, but also numerous other texts published in Baroda through the Baroda Oriental Institute. In 1940, the post was given to Prativadi Bhayankaram Anangaracharya, who was a prominent scholar and acharya from Kanchipuram. Again, this Sri Vaishnava sort of connection, which, again, I kind of deal with that in other parts of my work. So these, on the one hand, we have these sets of sources that talk about this trajectory, this kind of continuation of these pachshalas. But then I have sort of discovered another set of sources, which I won't get into now. But they sort of, in the 1920s, there's this person who publishes a monthly magazine in which he chastises all sorts of leadership for not significantly investing in these pachshalas and not significantly publishing texts. He says that the knowledge of Sanskrit is currently in a poor state. This is what people say. And he says, this is the first I've heard of this poor state of this vidya. Western scholars of Sanskrit praise this vidya, and they fund this study by the millions. And he sort of writes an editorial to the acharyas in 1940. And he says that that the curricula of the pachshalas need to be rethought. It should not be forgotten that it is through these efforts that the Sampradaya will advance, right? And so in 1940s, he's kind of echoing what Sajjanand Swami said in a century earlier. Currently, in kind of the old sort of the original Swaminarayan schools, there are many gurukuls and a few pachshalas that are set up. Let's get back to BAPS, which is where Bhadra Swami comes in. BAPS splintered off of the Vartal denomination in 1907 for a host of doctrinal considerations. And it is said that Shastriji Maharaj left Vartal with five sadhus and a handful of devotees and set the task of growing a new sampradaya, a new sansta. From 1907 to 1951, that was his sort of leadership. His main task was to grow the sampradaya and to establish a few temples. So he constructed five temples. He was said to have studied Sanskrit, but he also insisted that Pramukh Swami also study Sanskrit. And Pramukh Swami would become the guru in the sort of the next generation after his follower. So his immediate successor, Yogiji Maharaj, established the Akshapurushottam Sanskrit Pathshala in Mumbai in 1961. And here he had all of the young sadhus who had received diksha learn Sanskrit. But really we see these sort of these early years of a kind of a quiet, a more sort of a promulgation of Sanskrit in the background. But it is under Pramukh Swami that you see a real development of this. So in the first regard, in the 1970s, he directed a bunch of his sadhus who had already studied in the Pathshala to get PhDs in Sanskrit. And then another group in the 1990s, and this included Bhadir Swami and another sadhu who will be important for our discussion, Shruti Prakash Swami. He shifted the Sanskrit Pathshala from Mumbai to Sarangpur, which is a small village in Saurashtra. And he renamed it the Yagnapurush Sanskrit Mahavidyalaya. Now, in 2013, the Yagnapurush Sanskrit Mahavidyalaya became the BAPS Swaminarayan Mahavidyalaya and became connected to the newly formed Somnath Sanskrit University, which was established in 2008. And so now the Mahavidyalaya sort of, it operates in tandem with, on the one hand, every sadhu who receives initiation learns basic Sanskrit, but then the Mahavidyalaya is there to extend this and to sort of award degrees of Prakshastri, which is like a diploma, Shastri, which is a BA in Sanskrit, and Acharya, which is a master's. And there's a whole curriculum now that has been established. These sadhus who have received all this training are having all sorts of textual output. So we have, in 2013, Shruti Prakash Swami wrote the Akshar Purushottam Mahatmyam, which is a Sanskrit, another Sanskrit sacred biography, because the Satsangi Jivan was sort of seen as having a set of limitations, and the Akshar Purushottam Mahatmyam sort of recast that in sort of accordance with the Akshar Purushottam, the BAPS understanding, and encodes the lives of the gurus as well, up to Pramukh Swami in Sanskrit. Then, of course, there is Bhadir Swami, who in 2009 authors a commentary on the Brahma Sutras. In 2009, he also authors a commentary on several smaller Upanishads. In 2012, on the Chandogya and the Brihadaranyaka. In 2012, on the Bhagavad Gita. And so, in essence, by 2012, he has authored the what he calls the the Swaminarayana Bhashya. He writes a standalone treatise in 2017 called the Siddhanta Sudha. And in 2020, he translates a new text. Mahant Swami, the current guru, authors a new version of the Shikshapatri, if you will, in Gujarati. And Bhadir Swami rewrites it, or sort of encodes it in Sanskrit. So here we see, and I'm sorry I had to rush through quite a bit of this, but we see a protracted development of Sanskrit, both education and textual production. We see an initial stage during the time of Bhagwan Swaminarayan, and then continuing in the various denominations of the Swaminarayan tradition. And of course, there are all sorts of analyses that we can sort of look at the ways in which these are furthering the BJP government's sort of motives for Sanskrit education. But as I've sort of been trying to point to, I think a very sort of a more productive lens for us is to think about this through the development of a sampradaya, and thinking about these texts as developing devotees and as forwarding a conversation that these people who are writing in Sanskrit think is best suited for Sanskrit. So there's a lot that I still have to unpack, a lot that I want to do with this. I have not been able to talk about most of this.